Our class, as you know, I'll just get started while these brothers are passing out these handouts. These will be things you can reference, Lord willing, as our study progresses. Some of it we'll only be looking at it very momentarily, but I thought it was interesting, and it is tangentially related, at least, to our class. What's my subject for this week and next? Hosea. How many of you have made what you would consider a systematic, in-depth study of Hosea, either individually or in a group? Okay. That's not necessarily the sort of thing I would expect a lot of hands. I hope that after you leave this meeting, you can raise your hand. We're not going to be able to study it as in-depth as some of us might like. There are 14 chapters, and we're not even going to hit the book much today at all. So we're going to be flying at best. But still, I think we'll be able to give it a better shot than maybe we can in some circumstances. I want to start out by taking just a look at the minor prophets for a little bit. The minor prophets might be that part of the Bible where your pages are still stuck together. It's not the part of the Bible we look at a whole lot, or if we do, we only do it cursorily. Maybe we find a good verse for a sermon and we insert it in there. Maybe a little passage we have our children memorize. But for the most part, I think I can fairly safely say that most of us are not in a position where if someone says, "What is the book of Haggai about?" we've got something. Now, if I say, "What's 1 Corinthians about?" most of us have a whole bunch of stuff start coming into mind. What's the book of Acts about? Well, we know, but what's the book of Habakkuk about? I'm not sure. And I think that's a shame, and I feel that way more now than I did before I started the study, because the minor prophets, the prophets period, but the minor prophets, because that's what we're talking about, are just chock full of things that are very relevant for us today. Times have changed, but people haven't. The vices of men are the same as they've always been, and the minor prophets are addressing things that are very real for you and me. Jesus, the apostles, and the New Testament prophets considered the minor prophets important. All of the minor prophets, with the sole exception of Nahum and Obadiah, are quoted, or at the very least echoed, in the New Testament. Hosea, for example, we'll just go through a few of those. In Romans chapter 9, verse 25, when Paul is making the case that God endured with the Jewish nation in order that he could bring the gospel through Jesus to both Jew and Gentile, he makes his point by quoting Hosea. Romans chapter 9, verse 25, he says, "As he says also in Hosea, I will call them my people who were not my people, and her beloved who was not beloved." He's quoting there Hosea chapter 2, verse 23. He's saying that Hosea had been saying all along, 700 plus years ago, Hosea said that the Gentiles were going to be brought into the fold. Romans 9, 26, he quotes Hosea again. "It shall come to pass in the place where it was said to them, 'You are not my people,' there they shall be called sons of the living God." Romans 9, 26, he's quoting Hosea chapter 1, verse 10. Jesus quoted Hosea, one particular passage, twice, and both times to the Pharisees. In Matthew chapter 9, verse 13, he is at Matthew's house, and he's eating with the tax collectors and sinners. The Pharisees see this, and they want to know what a teacher is doing eating with the sinners, the tax collectors. And Jesus' response, Matthew 9, 13, is, "Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice." He's quoting Hosea. Hosea chapter 6, verse 6, and he does it again in Matthew 12. Matthew 12, verse 7, he and the apostles are out here gathering up grain, rubbing in their hands, eating it. It's a Sabbath day. The Pharisees say, "You're doing what's not lawful to do on the Sabbath." Jesus says, "If you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless." If you'd go back to the minor prophet and consider what he says, you'd know better than to feel the way you do about what I'm doing. Matthew 2, 15. When Jesus is being brought out of Egypt by Joseph and Mary, we have that famous statement from Hosea 11:1, "Out of Egypt I called my son." That's from the minor prophets. A couple other examples in Romans chapter 1, verse 17, when Paul is talking about the role of faith, he quotes Habakkuk 2 and 4, "The just shall live by faith." I don't know how many of you knew Brother Ray Stevens, particularly in his evening years of his life. This was a very favorite passage for him. Habakkuk 2 and 4, "The just shall live by faith." In Matthew chapter 2, verse 6, the wise men from the east, they're aware that the Messiah has been born, but they don't know precisely where, and the Jewish those who are informed are able to tell them. Micah 5:2 tells you, "But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not the least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you shall come a ruler. Out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." So the obvious, but just to make the point, Jesus, the apostles, the New Testament prophets, they regarded the minor prophets as worth our time. And we do well to do the same thing. And we do again because of the moral messages that are in them. Romans 15:4 says that the things which were written aforetime were written for what? They were written for our learning. And that includes the minor prophets. Men's vices are the same. Men are still killing, still stealing, still lying, still committing adultery, still following crowds, still trying to give God just as little as they can to get by. Men are still trying to give God what they want rather than what He wants. And I think the minor prophets are relevant to us now in a way that they weren't 30, 40 years ago in this country. Because we are now in a society where Christianity is not necessarily the accepted religion. My parents grew up in a country, and many of you here did also, in which you had a lot of people who weren't living the Christian life, but if you pressed them on it, they would say, "Yes, I believe Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Yes, I know that's what I ought to do. I'm not doing it. But if a guy's going to do the right thing, that's what he ought to do." You're meeting plenty of folks now who aren't saying that. My children are going to grow up in a world where they're going to hear a little bit about Jesus, but they're going to hear plenty also about Muhammad. They're going to hear plenty about Krishna, plenty about Buddha. Eric mentioned that in his lesson yesterday morning. We've got competition. There are rival religions. And that's the kind of environment that the minor prophets come into. Here's the truth. You're going after all these others. Reconsider. And again, I think it's relevant today in a way maybe it has never been before in our country. The minor prophets were certainly not the first of God's prophets. They came in a long line of prophecy, and I thought we could go through a little bit of that this morning. I'm going to start with this category. That's just a fancy name for the prophets that take us from the very beginning of time down to about the 900s BC, the 8th or 9th century BC. Now, from what we heard from Charles this morning, it's evident that we've had prophecy from the very beginning of time. Prophecy is whenever you foretell the will of God, whenever by inspiration you speak. And Adam was doing that when he wrote down that record. The only other way of looking at that is to say that Moses looked at what Adam had wrote and took out the good stuff and left the bad stuff, but it says it's the record of Adam. So I think we can safely say we've had prophecy from the very beginning. Who's the first man in the Bible called a prophet, though? Okay, Abraham is really close. What was it over here? Enos or Enoch. Abraham is the first one called a prophet in the Old Testament. Genesis chapter 20, verse 7. Abimelech is told by God in a dream, "Abraham is a prophet and he will pray for you." However, we had a man before him who's called a prophet in the New Testament. Jude 14 and 15, we find that Enoch prophesied. And without opening your Bible, what does Jude 14 and 15 tell us that Enoch prophesied about? And the coming judgment. All the way back in the days of Enoch, the end of the world was being prophesied, Jesus' return. Enoch, Abraham, and then, yes, Moses. Numbers chapter 12, verses 6 through 8 show us how Moses was very different from other prophets. God spoke to him as a man speaks with his friend. Now, while you had prophecy developing among the children of Israel with Abraham, with Moses, among the Jews, you did have prophecy in the Gentile world, real prophecy. And how do we know that? We had real prophets in the Gentile world, even while the Jewish nation was in existence. Job? All right, good point. Now, we don't know exactly where Job falls. Job would be a contemporary, possibly, of Abraham. So that's a good answer. I hadn't thought about that. So yes, Job would qualify. What's another man we know was prophesying who is among the Gentiles? Balaam. Numbers 22 through 24, Balaam is a Gentile, but God is using him. So that's an interesting thought. Even though you had the Jewish nation and God was giving them the oracles of God and was giving them greater revelation, the other people were not without witness. God didn't leave the Gentiles high and dry. There were prophets among them. So we go from Enoch to Abraham to Moses. We've got Balaam out there. And then prophecy among the Jews really took it got much bigger and more involved with the arrival of Samuel. In 1 Samuel chapter 3, verse 1, we read that when Samuel was a boy, the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no widespread revelation. There was revelation, but it wasn't widespread. Getting a revelation from God through a prophet was not necessarily a convenient or easy thing to do at all times. But that appears to have changed in Samuel's time. 1 Samuel chapter 4, verse 1, the word of Samuel came to all Israel, and Samuel wasn't working alone. 1 Samuel chapter 10, let's turn over there for a moment. Saul's just been anointed. The foundations of his world have been shaken. He is going to be king for a nation that's never even had a king. And in 1 Samuel chapter 10, after he is anointed right there at the beginning of the chapter, verse 2, Samuel says, okay, you're going to leave here, and here's what's going to happen. And among those things, in verse 5, 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 5, notice what Samuel says to Saul. After that, you shall come to the hill of God, where the Philistine garrison is, and it will happen when you come there to the city that you will meet what? A group of prophets. And notice what they're doing. Coming down from the high place with a stringed instrument, a tambourine, a flute, and a harp before them, and they will be prophesying. Prophesying with instruments. That's not the only place we encounter this in the Bible, as I recall. But here's a group of prophets. Now, when Samuel came on the scene, there was no widespread revelation. But now we've got this group of prophets. 1 Samuel chapter 19, verse 20. If you want to turn over there. Saul has found out where David is. He sends messengers to apprehend David. And 1 Samuel chapter 19, verse 20. Then Saul sent messengers to take David. And when they saw the group of prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing as leader over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. So not only do we have this group of prophets, but what's Samuel doing? All right, he's the leader. So the Bible doesn't use this term, but you could perhaps say he's the chief prophet. He's the one, he's the main vehicle. He's the leading vehicle, at least, but you've got these other prophets. He's presiding over them. This is the beginning. This is the first appearance in the Bible of a group of prophets that would come to be known as what? Well, it was a school of prophets of sorts, but it's the sons of the prophets. When you get into Elijah's ministry and Elisha's ministry, they seem to be, there's quite a few of them in this town over here, and you've got a lot of them together. And that's an interesting thing. Prophecy was almost like this thin stream down through history, but when you come to Samuel, there's this watershed. And now revelation becomes widespread. What might be the reason for that? What happened in Samuel's lifetime? The nation got a king. Before God had been its king, Samuel and men like him, not as good as he, most of them, but men like him had been judged. But now the kingdom's going to undergo this huge change. And in that environment, God makes revelation more available. I think that's interesting. In the transition time, Samuel and these other prophets are there as a stabilizing force. Big changes are in the works, but God is still revealing himself to us. All right. After Samuel, then, who would you say are the next most prominent prophets? We're all still in this category here. Yeah, definitely Elijah and Elisha. I like to liken this to three waves. This may not be a perfect analogy, and if it needs a correction, please let me know. Who is the first person in the Bible we see that God works miracles through? Moses, right? So to our knowledge, based on Scripture, there are no miracles prior to this. Then with Moses' arrival, now God's working these mighty miracles through Moses. And when Moses dies, God continues to work miracles. Through whom? Joshua. And of course, both of these men are making God's will known. Now, after that, power seems to disappear for the most part. The only exception I can think of being in the days of Jeroboam, the first king of the southern kingdom. We do have that man of God in 1 Kings 13 who causes his hand to wither. But that's the only exception I know. Miracles kind of seem to disappear until
Elijah and Elisha. And again, power wanes until who? Jesus, right? And the apostles. God does things in threes, and He does it here. And in this middle period of power, when Elijah and Elisha are on the scene, we see things that manifest God's power. Elijah performed a resurrection. 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 22. He raised the widow of Zarephath's son. He was involved in one resurrection. How many resurrections was Elisha connected to? Okay, two. And the second one's a little odd, maybe. In 2 Kings 4:35, Elisha raises the Shunammite woman's son. So we've got Elijah, he performs one, and Elisha performs this one in 2 Kings 4:35. But then there's that other. In 2 Kings 13:21, Elisha's dead, but his bones are over here. And the Moabite raiders come in, and they're trying to bury this body. And so they drop the body, and it touches Elisha's bones. And what happens? Boom. He resurrects. Now, yes, Elisha's dead, but it's still connected to him. Elijah performs two, Elisha's connected to two. Elijah performs seven miracles in his ministry. Elijah performs seven, Elisha performs ten. I think this is interesting. Elijah performs one resurrection, Elisha two. Seven miracles, ten miracles. What was it that Jesus told the apostles? John 14, 12, he who believes in me, he will perform the things I do, but he will also perform greater things. Jesus never spoke in tongues. The apostles did. And the apostles' miracles and works went out to many more people than did Jesus. Now, of course, it was all based on Jesus. Jesus broke the ground and made it all possible, but their work was far further reaching. I see that here. And if you'll bear with me for a moment, in 2 Kings chapter 2, when Elijah ascends into heaven, 2 Kings chapter 2, verse 11, Elijah and Elisha are there together. Then it happened as they continued on and talked, that suddenly a chariot of fire appeared with horses of fire and separated the two of them. And Elijah went up, how? By whirlwind. Some of you I know have heard me say this, but we teach our kids that he went up in a chariot of fire. And it's not what it says. The chariot of fire came down, divided them. Elijah went up by a whirlwind. Now notice what Elisha says in verse 12. Elisha saw it. He sees all this happen, Elijah going up. He saw it and he cried out, my father, the chariot of Israel and its horsemen. Have you ever wondered what that's about? I have. I've read that. Now, what's he talking about? And you might say, well, he's talking about that chariot he saw. But he says the chariot of Israel and its horsemen. There's no mention of horsemen prior to this. What's this about? I think we get insight later on in the book. If you'll go to 2 Kings 13, when Elisha dies, Joash is there. 2 Kings 13. And this is all related to that point I was making, if you'll just bear with me for a little bit longer. 2 Kings 13, verse 14, when Elisha dies, Elisha had become sick with the illness of which he would die. Then Joash, the king of Israel, came down to him and wept over his face and said, oh, my father, the what? The chariots of Israel and... Now, do you notice a difference between the statement about Elijah and the statement about Elisha? This is at the end of both of their lives here on earth. But there's one distinction. What's the difference? We got plural. Now, maybe I'm making a mountain out of a molehill. We've got a man who performed one resurrection. This man's connected with two. This man does seven miracles. This man does ten. When this man goes up, the chariot of Israel and his horsemen. Here's the strength of Israel. Israel was in debauchery and in Baal worship. Elijah, you brought us out. It was, of course, God, but you brought us out. You are the strength of Israel. But Elijah broke ground so that Elisha could do greater work. And when Elisha dies, what does Joash say? The chariots of Israel and their horsemen. His work was greater. I'd think that sort of thing is interesting, if my interpretation of it's correct. But that closes out for us this pre-classical period. And now we enter into what we can call the classical prophets. The classical prophets are going to take us from the 800s to the 600s BC, the 800s to the 600s BC, or the 9th to 7th centuries. And here's where we begin to have prophets whose writings we have. These men up here that we listed, and others in that time period, did they do any writing? One of them did. We heard a lot about him in previous class. Which one? Moses. We've got a whole bunch of writings of Moses, and we have those other men their works that Moses compiled. But we also have, there were books that we don't have anymore. 1 Chronicles 29, verse 29, we read of the book of Samuel, the seer, the book of Nathan, the prophet, the book of Gad, the seer. There's three books. We don't have any of them. Now, we may have excerpts from some of them in the Kings and Samuel, but we don't have those books themselves. 2 Chronicles 9, 29, we read of the prophecy of Ahijah the Shilonite, the visions of Iddo, and there are many more. But we did have writing going on, but it hasn't been brought down to us. Starting with the classical prophets, it's been brought down to us. In this category, we won't dwell on these too long. We've got men like Amos, Hosea, who we'll be studying, Isaiah. After this, we get to the exilic prophets. What men were prophesying in the time surrounding the exile and during it? Just three of them. Daniel, Ezekiel, and Jeremiah. Yes. Now, we do have one other book of prophecy in that time that's not given a name. We generally associate it with Jeremiah. Which book is that? Lamentations. I don't know of any absolute evidence which says Jeremiah actually wrote Lamentations. And as I understand it, at one time they were actually put in different parts of the Old Testament. They were put together later. But those are the exilic prophets. And then finally, Old Testament prophecy ends with what we can call the post-exilic prophets. Men like Haggai and Zechariah, who were encouraging the people to get on that temple. And no, this temple doesn't look all that impressive, but there's something very wonderful coming in the future. And Malachi closes it out in a time when the temple's built and they're worshiping, but they're doing it halfway as they had done it before. Okay. The minor prophets all fall in these last three categories, but I want to give you a different breakdown for them, one that maybe makes it a little bit easier. But before I do, 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 23. It's an important verse. It's an important verse from the standpoint of Hosea, as we'll deal with, if not today, tomorrow, Lord willing. But it's an important verse in light of the minor prophets. 2 Kings 14, verse 23 is the accession of Jeroboam to the power in Judah. And this is not Jeroboam the son of Nebat, or Naboth, the first Jeroboam. This is Jeroboam the second. He comes much later, and during him, as we're going to find out, Israel experiences this explosion of prosperity for just a little while before it all heads downhill and explodes. But from this point on, the minor prophets are at work. Starting in 2 Kings 14:23, from that point on, including Ezra and Nehemiah, the minor prophets are at work. And I'll just scribble these up here. We can put all the minor prophets in these three categories. When these three powers are having an influence on the nation of Israel, there are prophets at work. The Assyrian age is primarily the 700s B.C., your 8th century B.C. And I thought about writing these up here. I'll just list them for those of you who are taking notes. Under the Assyrian age, largely the 700s B.C., we have Hosea, Amos, Jonah, Micah, and Nahum. Hosea, Amos, Jonah, Micah, and Nahum. Under the Babylonian age, we just have two. This takes us from the 600s to the 500s BC. The Babylonian age takes us from the 600s to the 500s, and we've just got two, Habakkuk and Zephaniah. And then finally, under the Persian age, this takes us from the 500s to the 400s, and we've got three there, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Now, those of you who wrote those down, how many prophets did I list for you altogether under these three categories? 10, isn't it? Hosea, Amos, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. I feel like I'm in Bible school. There are two minor prophets I didn't mention, Obadiah and Joel. And I've not put them in these three categories because I'm not entirely sure where they belong. Some people favor a late date for Joel. Some people favor an early date. In my past studies, I've favored an early date, but I'm not in a position to say that with absolute certainty. Those two may belong in there somewhere. It's possible that they may even predate what the time period I gave you for the Assyrian age. But they're in there. All together, we've got 12 minor prophets. I'm going to stop there. Are there any comments or questions? I asked one of the elders if I could open it up during our study, and he gave me the go-ahead to try it. Are there any comments or questions? Okay. Oh, we've got one. Are we doing a microphone? Okay, Eldon. Oh. Yes, yes. Right. Okay. All right. Yeah, let me repeat that question for the tape. It was asked if this work of Elisha, which seems to be greater than Elijah's, is connected to the fact that Elisha asked for a double portion of Elijah's spirit. And I think that's a great connection, which, by the way, if I may diverge, I think that again is related to Jesus and the apostles. Remember what happened. Jesus brings the apostles to the Mount of Olives, I believe it is. He's blessing them, and he begins to ascend in their presence. And they're watching it, remember? They're watching it, just like Elijah watched Elisha, or the other way around. They're watching Jesus ascend. And after that, what had Jesus told them? You will receive after I'm gone. You're going to receive the Holy Spirit. And Elijah says to Elisha, if you see me, the thing you've asked for will happen. Elijah had been in despair, a temptation, but for a period of time he trains Elisha, then he leaves, and Elisha continues the work in a greater way. And that's just perfectly what Jesus and the apostles. Jesus is tempted in the wilderness, trains the apostles, ascends into heaven, and they go on and perform their work with his spirit. But excellent question. Was there another one? I thought I saw another hand. Yes. It is true. That is a possibility, yes. So I guess my periods of power are based on what is recorded. And there is the possibility that there were other things, yes. Marvin?
Is this what Jesus meant when he said the greater things than I have done you will do?
Yeah, Marvin asked if this is what Jesus meant when he referred to the apostles doing greater things. I think so. Yes, that their miracles, they spoke in tongues, for example, which he never did. They passed the Holy Spirit by laying on of hands, which he never did that exactly. And their miracles were further reaching and had greater consequences. Yes, I believe that's exactly what went on, and I think that's parallel to Elijah and Elisha. One more from Charles.
On two things. One, the double portion is a reference to the idea of receiving the portion of a firstborn in the household. Elisha was saying, basically, can I receive the inheritance of the firstborn when you go away? The firstborn received twice as much as anyone else.
Now, a spiritual firstborn type thing, though? Okay.
And the greater things Jesus referred to, I really think, refers to the fact that we preach a message of accomplished salvation. The apostles told people how to be saved. Jesus, in spite of the fact that he brought the kingdom into being in a very real sense, his preaching was all prelude.
Okay.
The kingdom is coming. And I don't think that their miracles might have taken on it. I don't think their miracles were more spectacular or outstanding than his. But that the fact that they were preaching and achieved salvation and
Okay. I'm going to try to condense what Charles said. He feels like the greater things that are mentioned in John 14:21 are not actually in reference to the miracles that the apostles performed in that. As he said, they're not more spectacular than what Jesus did. Thank you, Tom. But that he thinks the greater works were that the apostles actually preached the message of salvation, whereby men could be saved, and Jesus didn't ever give the total message that they did. Is that a fair assessment of what you said? Okay. That's the John Morris version. Okay. Let's talk about the arrangement of the 12 minor prophets. As some of you may know, although these books were probably almost certainly originally separate scrolls, they eventually were bound in to one book. In The City of God, written by Augustine in the 400s, he refers to the book of the 12 prophets. And the Jews refer to them as the 12 prophets. We have that over in Ecclesiasticus, an apocryphal book. Where they got the name minor prophets, I don't know. We do know that by Augustine's time, they were being called that. In his book, The City of God, he writes, "The prophecy of Isaiah is not in the book of the 12 prophets, who are called the minor." Now, we have a way in which we use minor in our language, but what is intended when the minor prophets are called the minor prophets? What's being implied there? They're smaller, they're shorter. And Augustine said that. He said, called the minor from the brevity of their writings as compared with those who are called the greater prophets. I mean, when you're looking at Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, you're looking at these mammoth works of prophecy, much larger than anything we have in the minor prophets. And I might just throw this out. I think I know that the prophets must seem very daunting to a lot of us. You know, maybe you make a decision, okay, I want to get familiar with this, so you open up to Malachi or you open up to Zechariah and you're reading it and I don't understand this. This language is not familiar to me. All these comparisons, I don't understand them. There's history here, I don't know. If you're going to start in the minor prophets, you know, pick a small one. Don't start in Isaiah. That's the sort of thing that's going to drown you. Go ahead and pick Malachi, which is just four chapters. And start there, baby steps, and gradually get into it that way. But I would definitely recommend getting into it. All right, just a quick comment. The order of the minor prophets is interesting in light of what we have up here. If you were reading out of the Septuagint, which Peter and Paul were reading out of, the minor prophets were in a different order than they are in our Bible. Our Bible follows the Masoretic text, which I'm sure Wade, he's told me, he's probably going to be hitting on some next week, and so I don't want to do too much about that. But the Masoretes were a group of scribes between the 500 and 1000 AD. They're best known for putting those vowel markings so that we know how to pronounce some of the old Hebrew. And very, very diligent in their guarding of the text. When they would get to a scroll, if the previous scribe had copied a letter too big, they didn't correct it. They just go ahead and copy it big. These were the words of God. We're not going to tamper with them. We might mark it and say, I don't understand this, but they would leave it. And they had everything counted so that everything could be as accurate as possible. I don't think man could go beyond what the Masoretes did. You'd have to get a computer to do any better. But from the 500 to 1000 at least, they're at work and they kept the Hebrew text together and they organized the minor prophets the way we have them. And there is a rhyme and reason to it. You'll notice as I was listing these that as I listed them, it was pretty much the order you had them in the Bible. So they're ordered according to the Assyrian period, the Babylonian period, and the Persian period. And then even within those categories, if you look at the Persian prophets, they're in chronological order. If you look at the Babylonian prophets, they're in chronological order. The Assyrian period, perhaps not. But there is an order there. Just interesting to know. I had a few other things I was going to mention, but I'll go ahead and mention them here in a minute. Any comments or questions on that? I'll take one question or comment if you have it. Okay. Let me say one final thing. Don't get the impression, and I don't know that anyone here has this, but because I know the prophets can be daunting, they've been that way to me, you might just feel like, well, it's just this big mass of stuff that you don't know what to do with. I don't understand any of it. It all sounds the same. If you've read one, you've read them all. There is a huge, rich diversity even in the minor prophets.
For example, when you're reading Hosea, the first three chapters of Hosea are, there's a part of it that's devoted to this life that Hosea is living. And what he's told to do, he's told to go marry this woman. And there's this narrative involved in addition to all the oracles that we have. And we have some of that in Amos also. I mean, Amos going up to the northern kingdom from the southern kingdom where he lives and meeting up with Amaziah at Bethel, who's a priest there, and him telling Amos, go back home. Don't ever prophesy here again. Don't you come back no more. That sort of thing, it makes the text a little more interesting than you might expect. And there's a lot more diversity. Jonah, he's a minor prophet. But what's the whole minor prophet about? It's a story. It's this very interesting story that we all know and we all teach the kids and we all think is interesting. Well, it's in the minor prophets. We get to Zechariah. I remember the first time I sat down with the book of Zechariah and decided I was going to diligently give it some attention, just reading it. I was in college. It's too late to start, but I started then. And if you haven't read the first few chapters of Zechariah, let me encourage you, if you can find some time today, just sit down and start reading it. It's some of the most fascinating reading in the Bible. It's these eight visions, and it's you feel like you're reading Daniel or Revelation. Just fascinating, and it's in there, in the minor prophets. Habakkuk also. What is the whole book of Habakkuk about? Can anyone give me a general idea? What is Habakkuk doing? How does the book start? He doesn't understand why God is acting or not acting as he is. There is no preaching in the book of Habakkuk. The whole book is a conversation between the prophet and God. It's just very interesting. There's a lot of diversity in there. So as one man put it, when we don't pay any attention to this part of the Bible, we're really robbing ourselves of our birthright. There's a lot there, and it's very relevant, as I hope we're going to see when we get into Hosea, which let's do that now. Let's go to Hosea chapter 1. Okay, I don't want to get you too excited. We're going to cover all of one verse today. Just so you know it's coming. Hosea chapter 1, verse 1. The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. We get the who, we get the what, and we get the when. In this verse, Hosea is the prophet's name. What's Hosea mean? I'm sure you got a note there somewhere. Salvation. Salvation, deliverance, help. His name is shared by four other men in the Bible who, ironically, we do not know as Hosea. A couple of them are not guys I would expect you to know, but in 2 Kings chapter 17, verse 1, we meet a Hosea. But it's Hosea is how it's translated. I don't understand why translators do this. It's a constant frustration to me. I think Charles was kind of hinting at some of this with that word in Genesis. We've got the same Hebrew word here, Hosea, but they choose to translate it Hosea over here and Hosea over here. And not a huge deal, but I think it kind of confuses us. Hosea, who was he? King of Israel. And in what order was he? He was the last. He would have been reigning in Israel quite possibly. Hosea may have, well, I'm not sure if Hosea could have been alive at that time or not. He may have been. One promoting God's message and the other completely disregarding it. What other man do we know in the Bible who had the same name as Hosea, but we don't know him by that name? Absolutely. That's good. I didn't necessarily expect that kind of reaction. Numbers chapter 13, verse 8, we meet Hosea, the son of Nun, or the son of Nun. But in Numbers 13:16, 8 verses later, Moses called Hosea, the son of Nun, Joshua. Now, what did Hosea mean again? Salvation. What does Joshua mean, or Jehoshua? Now, what is, I'm sorry, I'm losing my,
God is my salvation, or God's salvation. It's an interesting change, isn't it? You got a good name, Hosea. That salvation, that's a good thing. But here's a better name. God saves. And who else in the Bible shares this name, but we know him by the Greek version of it? Jesus. Jesus and Joshua have the same name. Jesus and Yehoshua, or Yehoshua, are the same name. All right. Hosea is said here to be the son of Beeri. We don't know anything about this man. I've seen nothing convincing that would lead me one way or the other. We do have a man by that name in Genesis 26. Genesis 26:34, one of Esau's fathers-in-law was named Beeri, but we can be certain that wasn't this man. Early Jewish writers said that Beeri was the man mentioned in 1 Chronicles 5:6. Beera, there, B-E-E-R-A-H, who was carried away into captivity by Tiglath-Pileser. He was a Reubenite. I don't know what they based that on. Perhaps that's true, perhaps not. There was an ancient Christian tradition which said that Hosea was from the tribe of Issachar, so it disagrees with that. We don't really know who this Beeri was, except that he was the father of Hosea. Hosea was very possibly a native of the northern kingdom, and that's significant, which I'll mention why here in a moment. He never tells us that outright, but there are some indications in the book. For example, in chapter 7, verse 5 of Hosea, when speaking of the king of Israel, the expression "our king" is used. Now, that's not necessarily the sort of language that a man would use if he's from Judah. That would seem possibly to indicate that he considers himself a part of this northern kingdom, that he's in there with them. In the original text, and I'm certainly no Hebrew scholar, I'm not even a Hebrew amateur, as I understand it, the language in Hosea has a lot of what are called Aramaisms, and this would indicate that this would be a northern dialect. Possibly. So the language would indicate that the man was not coming from Judah, but from Israel. At least so believe some. If that's true, if he was from the northern kingdom, that makes him the only writing prophet from the northern kingdom to prophesy to the northern kingdom that we have. No other man would fall in that category. We do have a prophecy from Jonah in 2 Kings 14:25 concerning Israel. But we don't have it where he wrote it down. We just have it mentioned there. So Hosea may be in a category all by himself from that standpoint. Hosea may have been a farmer. When we look at the book of Hosea, we do see several symbols connected with agriculture and rural life, as if this was the thing he was familiar with. God does work with us as we are. You know, God could do anything, but he does take the raw material and he uses that. Why is it that Peter is the one who speaks on the day of Pentecost? Why do we have Peter talking? Because what was Peter by nature? Well, he was a leader by nature. He was also a talker by nature, wasn't he? I mean, he was the guy. When John probably knew more. The deepest things about Jesus' ministry and Jesus' identity are in the books that John wrote. But John wasn't the guy who stepped out before he thought. When he got to the tomb, remember, he stopped there. Peter just barrels right on in. And Peter was the one who said, "Bid me come out on the water." The other guys are cowering in the boat, and Peter's ready to jump out there. God used what Peter had. He used what John had. He used what Paul had. He took that material. And so when we see in a prophet a lot of references to a particular thing, it may well be an indication that that's something this man's familiar with. He may have been a farmer. His contemporary Amos, what was Amos's occupation? A shepherd or a sheep breeder. And that wasn't the only thing. He did one other thing. What was it? Tender of sycamore fruit. A tender of sycamore fruit. Amos chapter 7, verse 14, which, by the way, that's not like the American sycamore. That's a type of fig. And his tending would have been, they would take a little hook-like tool and they would cut the fruit, and that would cause it to ripen sooner. That was the kind of work that he did. All right. Hosea tells us in what time period he prophesied, and this may, I don't know if we'll get much further than this morning. He prophesied in the reigns of these five kings, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, who were kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. It would be nice to be able to just take a bunch of dates and write them up here on the board today. And say, this is when Uzziah began his reign. This is when Jeroboam began his reign. This is when Hezekiah began his reign. And his reign ended. But if you'll notice in the sheets I've given you, we've got a list of the kings of Israel here. And next to them we have four columns of dates. And you'll notice that none of those dates agree. These are Bible-believing men who are trying to make sense of the chronologies that we have in 1 and 2 Kings, and none of them match up. This is evidence of a great difficulty we have when we approach Old Testament chronology, and I wanted to just touch on it a little bit. We know the Bible is reliable. There's no question on that. What we don't know is what all factors were playing in to what the men wrote at the time. Let me give you an example of what the problem is, if problem's a fair description of it. Who was the first king of Israel after the division? Rehoboam. Well, he's of Judah, pardon me. And then over in Israel you have Jeroboam. Okay. These men come to power about the same time. Now, in 2 Kings 9, 24 through 27, I'm not going to take time to read it, but 2 Kings chapter 9, 24 through 27, we have the death of Ahaziah and the death of Joram. Joram is the ninth from Jeroboam. Ahaziah is the sixth from Rehoboam. These men die pretty much the same time. Who kills them? Jehu. Yes. All right. So, we have the number of years that these men reigned in between. So we should be able to take all the numbers here and all the numbers here, add them up, and get the exact same answer. Right? No? Well, we don't get the same answer, and Charles' answer is really more correct. Based on our Western presuppositions, imputing those to the Bible, you would expect to get the same numbers, as I understand it. But that's not what we're dealing with. If you add these up, you get 95 years. If you add this up, you get 98 years, 7 days. What's going on? And the skeptic says, well, your Bible's not reliable. It's not the case. What we do have going on are many things, and I'll just write this author's name up here. You'll notice one of the columns on that sheet is by this man, Thiel. His book is entitled The Mysterious Numbers of the Hebrew Kings. He is a Bible believer. He accepts the Bible as God's word, and he tries to make these things work. And his is the only of these four I've looked at. It's interesting. I would say that the book is worth the money just from the standpoint of the first maybe 30 or 40 pages where he describes the problem we have, why it exists, and partly what we can do about it. What we find out when we start looking at ancient history is that we have, for example, one among many things that affects this are what are called co-regencies. For example, does anybody know the name of Nebuchadnezzar's father? Yes, Nabopolassar. Nabopolassar was king. Nabopolassar died in 604 BC. Nebuchadnezzar shared a reign with him for 2 years, from 606 to 604 BC. And then Nabopolassar died in 604. All right, so you have Nabopolassar, Nebuchadnezzar, and they overlap for 2 years. Now, if you're going to write a history of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, when are you going to start his reign? Are you going to say he was king in 606 when there was another man king? Or are you going to say he started his reign after the other man died? Well, in our Western tradition, we're probably going to throw in both because we want to make sure we get everything. But that's not how ancient historians worked. The Jews dated Nebuchadnezzar's reign from 606. The Babylonians dated it from 604. Both are right. But unless we knew about that co-regency, we would think there was a discrepancy. And that's the sort of thing we're seeing in the Bible. Solomon becomes king in 1 Kings 1:39. When does David die? Chapter 2, verse 10. How long is David alive, or how long does David live during Solomon's reign? Charles says quite a while. You know something I don't.
Looking at what it says at the end of 1 Chronicles
All right. Okay, but do we have an exact number? Not that I'm aware of. So if we hadn't thought about that, we'd say, well, 40 years Saul, 40 years David, 40 years Solomon. It was 120 years. But it wasn't. And we don't know what the overlap was. We can only make educated guesses. We can take things from outside of the Bible, which may or may not be reliable, and try to make them mesh. But that's just one example. Another one, 2 Kings chapter 15, verse 5. Uzziah is king. He gets big for his britches. In his arrogance, he goes into the temple. He's going to offer incense on the altar of incense. The priests are trying to stop him. And what's God do? Hits him with the leprosy. And out goes Uzziah. Uzziah spends the rest of his life in an isolated house. Is he king? Yes. But we're told in 2 Kings 15, verse 5, that Jotham is over the royal house. Jotham is exercising some power here. And you'll notice if you look on the sheet, down here, well, it's going to be on the kings of Judah, of course. It lists Uzziah's name in parentheses. It's got him here as Azariah. With the exception of the first column, the Hayes and Hooker column, you'll notice when comparing the reigns of Uzziah and Jotham that these other three chronologists have them overlapping. But they don't agree on how much overlap there was. And it's again because we just don't know. So, I can't put dates up here for sure on when these men reigned because we just don't know with absolute certainty. If we take Thiel's chronology, Jeroboam's reign ends, Jeroboam the second, down there about midway, his reign ends in 841, or 753, 753 B.C. That's the end of Jeroboam the second's reign. Now, Hosea says he prophesied during the reign of Jeroboam. So let's assume that Hosea comes in here right at the end of Jeroboam's reign. Now, who's the last king reigning when Hosea stops prophesying? Hosea 1:1. Hezekiah. Now, Field tells us, his opinion is, Hezekiah's reign began in 716 B.C. So, if Hosea begins right at the end of Jeroboam's and goes right to the very beginning of Hezekiah, that gives us a prophetic period of 37 years. Chances are he reigned for more than that, or he prophesied for more than that. We could have a man prophesying here 60 years, maybe more. One of the only limiting factors would be just the nature of the human body and the fact that Hosea does get married. Now, as I understand it, early marriages were, the early marriages did take place in Israel. So let's say he gets married at 20 and he prophesies for 60 years. We have a man who dies at 80. This man spent most of his life, very possibly, prophesying these messages to a nation. This makes him contemporary with Isaiah, with Amos, Micah, and Jonah, as I mentioned already. In fact, in Isaiah 1:1, the exact same kings are mentioned with the exception of Jeroboam. So when Isaiah is prophesying to Judah and Jerusalem, here's Hosea prophesying to the north, both speaking God's message to a different nation. Any comments or questions on that material? Okay, thank you, Tom. We've got just about 4 minutes left here. Let's get into the political circumstances that existed when Hosea began prophesying. After the division, the kingdoms waxed and waned after the division after Solomon's death. But Israel, prior to Jeroboam the second coming to power, had gotten pretty bad. Remember over in 2 Kings, let's turn over there, when Elisha met with Hazael from Syria, who would eventually become king. 2 Kings chapter 8. Start in verse 7. 2 Kings chapter 8, verse 7. Then Elisha went to Damascus, and Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, was sick. And it was told him, saying, "The man of God has come here," verse 8. And the king said to Hazael, take a present in your hand and go to meet the man of God, and inquire of the Lord by him, saying, shall I recover from this disease? So Hazael went to meet him and took a present with him of every good thing of Damascus, 40 camel loads, and he came and stood before him and said, your son Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, has sent me to you, saying, shall I recover from this disease? Elisha said to him, go, say to him, you shall certainly recover. However, the Lord has shown me that he will really die. Then he set his countenance in a stare until he was ashamed. And the man of God wept. And Hazael said, why is my Lord weeping? He answered, because I know the evil that you will do to the children of Israel. Their strongholds you will set on fire, and their young men you will kill with the sword, and you will dash their children and rip open their women with child. So Hazael said, but what is your servant, a dog, that he should do this gross thing? Elisha answered, the Lord has shown me that you will become king over Syria. And in the following verses, we learn where that comes to pass. Now when Hazael comes to power, he begins to do those things that Elisha said. Elisha said, you're going to hurt Israel. And he did. It began before him, though. 2 Kings chapter 10 is where we start seeing it. Chapter 10, beginning in verse 32. In those days, I'll give you a chance to turn over there. 2 Kings chapter 10. It begins in the days of Jehu, starting in verse 32. In those days, the Lord began to cut off parts of Israel, and Hazael conquered them in all the territory of Israel, from the Jordan eastward, all the land of Gilead, Gad, Reuben, and Manasseh, from Aroer, which is by the river Arnon, including Gilead and Bashan. So what do we see happening? While Hazael is king in Assyria, the northern kingdom is doing this. They can't hold their borders. They can't fight off the Syrians. They're shrinking and shrinking. 2 Kings 13, 22 says, Hazael, king of Syria, oppressed Israel all the days of Jehoahaz. So he oppresses them in the days of Jehu. He oppresses them in the days of Jehoahaz. The northern kingdom is shrinking, shrinking, suffering. Eventually, the kingdom gets so bad, 2 Kings 13, this is where we'll close for this morning. 2 Kings 13, beginning in verse 3. Then the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel, and he delivered them into the hand of Hazael, king of Syria, and into the hand of Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael, all their days. So Jehoahaz pleaded with the Lord, and the Lord listened to him, for he saw the oppression of Israel because the king of Assyria oppressed them. Then the Lord gave Israel a deliverer, so that they escaped from under the hand of the Syrians, and the children of Israel dwelt in their tents as before. Nevertheless, they did not depart from the sins of the house of Jeroboam, who had made Israel sin, but walked in them, and the wooden image also remained in Samaria. Now note verse 7. For he left of the army of Jehoahaz, this is the national army, only 50 horsemen, 10 chariots, and 10,000 foot soldiers. For the king of Syria had destroyed them and made them like the dust at threshing. Can you imagine trying to protect a kingdom with that army? There's nothing. You exist only because the king of Syria doesn't want to bother with you. It's easier to just take what he wants when he wants it than to bother completely conquering you. The kingdom is down to almost nothing. Tomorrow we'll begin with what happens just before Hosea comes upon the scene. A revolution takes place and Israel experiences an amazing success for a while.